Everyone, and thank you for joining us for November's Exotics Club webinar. I'm delighted to welcome our speaker for today, Senior Clinical Scholar at the Royal Dick School of Veterinary Studies, University of Edinburgh, Martin Lewis. Thank you, Martin. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Thank you, Emma, and welcome to this webinar on indications for computed tomography in reptiles, or as I've been told I have to call it, CT or not to CT. Sorry about that. So I thought I'd start with a little bit of CT history. And CT was developed in the 1970s by Godfrey Hounsfeld and A.J. Cormack. And originally things were not great. Scans were initially very slow, and this was really because the patients had to be manually moved forward between each scan slice. And imaging resolution was poor as well, with highly pixelated images, which meant that crucial detail could be lacking from small areas of interest or some of the small patients. And this is especially important for exotic animals, as many of the animals that we see are very, very small. In 1987, the first spherical scanner was produced, and this was basically the same sort of model that we see today, where we have a scanner which continuously rotates around a patient moving through on a mobile gantry, and this has benefited by significantly increasing the speed of scans. From a historical veterinary perspective, CT has largely been regarded as an inaccessible and an unaffordable diagnostic option for the majority of our patients, and it was really restricted to a small number of referral practices and university and research institutions. So if we sort of fast forward onto today, the current standard veterinary CT in the UK is looking an awful lot brighter, and there have been some rapid increases in the availability, especially over the last decade or so. And we now have more than 20 dedicated veterinary CT scanners spread throughout the UK. The technology itself has obviously moved on very rapidly as well, and helical CT scanners, which are very much like the sort of spherical scanners, and multiple slice technology are now the norm, and computers have come a huge way as well, and they're capable of processing much faster and storing far greater amounts of data. And really the summation of this is that scan times are dramatically reduced, and image resolution is far greater as well. And this is all, you know, this is all wonderful news for our small exotics patients. It's still more common to see them in referral centres and universities, and like this, the pictures I've got here of the wonderful facility we've got at Edinburgh. But the situation is certainly changing, and we're starting to see far more in a first opinion practice setting. The costs have also come down quite a lot. Scans now cost anywhere from about £350 to £800, and that really depends on the institution, whether they're using contrast agents, time in hospital, all of that sort of stuff, and also whether there are any sort of specialist images that might be involved. But unfortunately, it's still considered a largely unaffordable option for many of our reptile patients who still sort of lag behind in terms of insurance and things like that. I just thought I'd put a few images here to illustrate the range of species that we have imaged at Edinburgh. And on the left-hand side, we've got this wee sugar glider, and he was diagnosed with a retrobulbar abscess, and this can be a very difficult condition to identify using traditional radiography. At the top, there's a 15-foot reticulated python. And really, this patient was completely conscious. He was restrained only using a length of plastic tubing. We had to buy the tubing specifically for him, but he was sat in there quite happily. And amazingly, after we put him through an entire full body CT scan, it turned out that he had a bit of chronic rhinitis. The bottom middle is an African pygmy hedgehog, and off on the right there's a splendid ram who was diagnosed with a cervical spinal fracture after running into another ram, and he's probably the largest animal that's received a full body CT at Edinburgh. Now for a bit of CT general knowledge, and I'm sure everybody already knows, CT scan stands for computer assisted radial tomography, and it's really just it's basically a 3D imaging modality where thousands of individual transverse X-ray images, and these are called slices, are generated by a rotating X-ray tube. These slices are then reconstructed into 3D images by a computer, And patients, and in this case, it's a sort of 7 foot boa constrictor, are placed on a gantry, as I mentioned previously, and this moves through the CT scan at a predicted, predetermined speed. CT images are measured in Hounsfield units, and this was named after its inventor. And they're a measure of the attenuation of the X-rays by matter or body tissues through which they're passing. And water was given the reference standard value of 0 Hounsfield units. And then from that you have air, which goes down to -1,000 Hounsfield units. Soft tissues are a bit tricky, and they sit sort of more in around the +30 to +100 Hounsfield unit mark. Bone is a bit more sort of solid and predictable at around 1,000. And heavy metals and things like that show up very nicely. You're looking at more than 3,000 Hounsfield units. They do show up very, very nicely. So I guess it's quite easy to see that plain CT works very well at separating structures when there's a great difference in the attenuation between them. For example, if you have bone, that will show up very next to well next to soft tissue, or air, where you have -1,000 next to soft tissue, where it's drifting around sort of 30 to 100. But historically, differentiating between adjacent or interfacing soft tissue structures has been difficult, and has been regarded as a significant limitation of the technology. This issue has partly been addressed by the use of intravenous iodine contrast media, and the contrast media really serves to create a greater difference in attenuation between two vascular structures that have similar Hounsfield units. You can also use it to give you some information of the function of that organ, so clearance of the contrast media through an organ can be very useful. And examples of this include rate of renal function, based on the clearance of contrast media, and cardiac evaluation, so stuff like angiography, which we more commonly see being used in pet birds with atherosclerosis, but it can also be applied to reptiles. There's really no reason why you couldn't do very similar sorts of things. So I thought I'd just run through a few of the sort of typical challenges that we have in diagnosing disease in our reptile patients, and then hopefully move on to how CT has helped to correct some of that. And the first one really is is the history. So it's not common for reptile histories to be very vague and nonspecific, as I'm sure you've all found. And this makes it difficult for us as clinicians to focus on specific areas of concern. The major ongoing problem is that chronic husbandry issues really sit at the center of so many of the problems that we see. And these issues result in chronic physiological derangements, and sometimes you end up with multiple organ dysfunction, hepatic lipidosis, obviously a major issue. And then, of course, sometimes we're seeing second, third, fourth, whatever hand reptiles, and the current owner may have had them for a very short period of time, and they may have all the best intentions, and they may want to do whatever it takes to sort their reptiles out. But practically, they have very little information about previous husbandry or medical or surgical problems. And again, all of this just sort of contributes to a very mixed and confusing picture. The next thing to consider is the physical exam, and obviously our chelonian patients, the tortoises and the turtles, they represent a very obvious challenge in this respect, but it's really not limited to this group. So we'll commonly find issues with visualizing lesions, and there may be difficulty in palpating areas of concern, and the use of auscultation in identifying problems such as heart or lung pathology is also dramatically hampered. And the problems persist if we start to consider other things like blood tests, urine tests, stuff that we would standardly do in other animals, as they can provide us with very few answers sometimes. So it's very common for us to rely very heavily on imaging. But imaging reptiles can also present rather significant challenges. So I thought I'd run through just a few of the more obvious issues that we find with ultrasound and radiography, as these are by far the most commonly used imaging modalities in first opinion and referral centres. So if we have a wee look at ultrasound first, as I'm sure many of you have found, there are typically very few windows available for scanning reptiles. So for example, in our tortoises and turtles and things like that, you only really have the prefemoral fossa or the cervicobrachial window. And in snakes and a lot of lizard species, you have an extensive rib cage present. which can significantly reduce the amount of space you have to scan these guys. The presence of scales or osteoderms and scutes, they may also inhibit passage of ultrasound waves or allow for pockets of air to form, which can cause artifact. Snakes close to shedding have an additional thickness to their dermal barrier, and again, this can affect the movement of the ultrasound waves. And then you find that the presence of gas either in the lungs or the intestines can cause some quite significant scanning difficulties, and herbivorous tortoises are quite common in this respect. If we look at patient size, and this is a huge problem, almost regardless of imaging modality, but with regard to ultrasound specifically, it's a very common issue in our tortoise and turtle patients, as I just mentioned, and largely this is due to a significant restriction in the probe maneuverability. The sort of prefemoral fossa and the cervical brachial windows may just be too small to use the standard probes used in dogs and cats. Small lizards, while they don't have a shell, they do have a lot of very superficial skeletal structures, and again, very small windows for placement of probes. So you may have to use more specialist equipment, things like standoffs, which can make interpretation even more tricky. Or if you're doing a lot of scanning, then it might be worth considering buying a smaller probe, but obviously this can be quite expensive. On the other hand, if you have very large patients, for example, this very beautiful but very stubborn Solcata tortoise, it may be impossible to access ultrasound windows due to withdrawn head or limbs. And there's also the potential risk of finger or probe entrapment, which can be very painful, and obviously can damage expensive equipment. It may be difficult to image deeper structures, so for example the kidneys and some of the very large chelonia. Larger lizards, such as you get some big iguanas or some of the varanid species, can be quite grumpy and they can be difficult to physically restrain. So then you start drifting into the requirement for sedation, and if we are considering sedating some of these patients, we really have to consider the safety of them, because many of them will come in quite severely debilitated. The next issue we run into is ultrasound interpretation, and this can be a really big problem because interpretation is technically challenging, especially if you're unfamiliar with what's normal. Reptiles have a relatively unique anatomy, so for example many of the lizards have their kidneys tucked away in the pelvis, and there's also the sort of elongated nature of many of the snake organs. And some organs such as the gonads will change size and shape depending on things like season. So you really do have to be very familiar with normal anatomy. If we turn now to have a quick run through radiography, and again, there can be a number of challenges to overcome when you're X-raying and interpreting X-ray in some of the reptile species. And the first is that X-rays have a bit of a difficulty penetrating the chelonian exoskeleton or the osteoderms of some of the lizards. And this can lead to generation of artifact, which again can hamper your interpretation. The next is that with traditional radiography, obviously we use multiple positional views to sort of help triangulate internal lesions. And this is to overcome a really big problem, which is that of superimposition. And this is an inherent drawback to 2D imaging. When radiographing reptiles who lack a diaphragm and whose celomic organs are more subject to sort of gravity-related movement, ideally you'd have access to a horizontal beam X-ray machine so that the tube head could be moved rather than the patient. As you can see on the image on the left, the X-ray tube has been rotated to about 90 degrees so that you can achieve a sort of lateral horizontal view without having to position the patient oddly. This sort of requirement for lateral imaging, but if you don't have access to horizontal beam, has given rise to some imaginative solutions. So an example is this uromastix, where the referring vet has placed the patient in a box and put him in lateral recumbency and then used folded towels to restrain her in this position. And imaging in this way relies on either having a very compliant or, what are more commonly, very badly debilitated patients in order to achieve these. And again, it contributes to stress in the animal. It contributes to the generation of artifact and things like that. And another significant problem, which really relates to large snakes specifically, is requirement for taking numerous orthogonal views of your patient. And so, you know, if we're looking at big snakes, and again, if you this boa on the left hand side there, we may need to be taking 6, 8, 10 plus views in order to achieve full body imaging, and the images need to be numbered so that you can accurately identify where your lesions are. And in this patient, which again was the 7 foot boa, it took some time to not only just to image it, but also to interpret this, as I'm sure you can imagine. So if we sort of drift back to CT and how it's helped with some of the problems I've just mentioned, if we start by looking at some of the benefits of 3D imaging just generally, and I put this as a general thing because it's true for MRI as it is for CT. And the first benefit that it addresses is something I mentioned a couple of moments ago, and that is that there's no superimposition. And so the main difference between radiography and CT is that with radiography, all of the tissues within an area of interest are superimposed in a single two-dimensional image. And this really means that each anatomical structure within that image is harder to distinguish from the structure surrounding it. And CT removes this problem in its entirety and allows us to see and appreciate every individual organ. Second is that we can achieve very detailed anatomic localization. So, and this really means that the images are better able to describe the exact extent of the lesion and the disease process. And it's valuable information also provided about the relationship that the lesions have with any neighboring structures. This achieves better surgical planning, so being able to visualize normal and abnormal structures in 3D enables very exact decision making when it comes to surgical planning. The image is in the slide of a female boa again, and I'll come back to this case again in the section toward the end on musculoskeletal imaging. But these images really show a bony growth which is spreading to include about 5 separate ribs. The transversal image on the right shows the width of the lesion at its widest point and indicates there's no involvement in underlying structures. And CT was ideal in this situation for deciding the nature of subsequent surgeries that were going to be performed. Next one we have is an ability to identify concurrent conditions. And really this is because we can do full body imaging in most of our patients. So in this case, this was a 70-year-old female tortoise that was presented for evaluation of a soft tissue mass on a left caudal humeral region, which is circled in yellow there. The mass had been slow growing and the patient had remained pretty well for I think it was about 6 or 9 months or so. And so the owners have really just elected to keep an eye on things. But in the month before presentation, she'd become quite quiet, lethargic, inappetent, and so she decided to bring her into us. And other than the mass, her physical examiner blood work was pretty unremarkable. So we performed a CT scan. And this was initially with the purpose of the surgical planning, but we also managed to identify numerous what seemed to be very healthy follicles in her celomic cavity. She then had an FNA of the mass, which indicated it was an abscess, and the CT demonstrated that there was no involvement of any of the underlying structures. So surgery was really just a sort of conservative mass resection. And then over the following weeks, the follicles were monitored with ultrasound, but this was larger due to financial concerns, because you can very successfully use CT scans as they're really an excellent way of monitoring follicle progression. But ultrasound worked very effectively in this case. Post-surgical healing went well and the skin sutures were removed around 8 weeks or so. And then the follicles regressed normally and ultimately the patient returned to normal over the sort of 6 to 8 week period. And so we're assuming that the initial vague behavior that she was showing when she was presented was possibly because of the follicles rather than the mass, which really had been minding its own business for quite a long time. So fifth, we have a sort of improved prognostic value and we have improved outcomes, so it's obviously very, very important. And this is really just due to a summation of the previous points. And so if we have improved lesion localization and more accurate determination of the extent of the disease process, if we can identify concurrent problems, then we can give owners a more accurate prognosis. And this can also be used to more accurately target further diagnostics, so things like finding needle aspirates or biopsy, or for therapeutic interventions such as surgery or radiotherapy. And really, last point was that this is especially useful for so many of our chelonium patients. And 3D imaging has made a huge difference to diagnosing pathology in these guys. Looking at some of the additional specific benefits of just related to CT, and really the first and probably most important is that the scans are just very, very fast, and they're dramatically faster than a typical MRI. So a scan will take around 10 or 15 minutes, and really this includes patient positioning. It's also become the norm for us not to use any sedation or general anesthetic in the majority of these patients, and this significantly improves patient safety. It also means that advanced imaging can be fitted into a busy clinic. We do have a very, very busy clinic here, and it provides an excellent speed of turnaround for our day patients. And the picture here is of obviously there's the reticulated python, which we saw before, but the other one is a wee turtle, which is being put through a scanner at UGA. And the picture on the right is lovely Jessica Comley, who works. She's one of the residents at UGA, and I promise I would mention her if I put a picture in there. So thanks, Jess. And a particular value of CT is in the investigation of trauma, and this has been found to be very true. I missed a bit. I was going to mention a bit of CT guided sampling. So this is quite an interesting benefit of, and it relates again to the speeds of the and the detailed images that we get from some of the scans. And it's really the ability to perform something called CT guided sampling. So, and these are procedures where sampling needles, and these can be either biopsy or fine needles, can be placed very accurately and then repositioned as required based on repeated short CT scans of very small areas of interest. And again, in terms of tortoises and turtles, this is especially useful. And you can use it for sampling neoplastic growths, bony irregularities, or fluid pockets that are sort of tucked away somewhere. And then, this is where I wanted to be. So finally, we have a really sort of particular value of CT is in the investigation of trauma. And this has been found to be very true in human hospitals. So it's not uncommon for reptiles, a bit like everybody else, to suffer various traumatic incidents, for example, dog bites, road traffic accidents, maybe trodden on or dropped, whatever. And this commonly results in polytrauma, so possibly the with the involvement of multiple body systems and multiple areas of skeletal damage. And in the human field, there are a number of studies published in this area, but I picked out a study from 2009, which is published in The Lancet. And this was a retrospective multi-center study from Germany looking at 4,621 patients. And it compared survival outcomes in two groups, one group that had whole body CT during resuscitation and another that did not. And the findings of the study were that integration of whole body CT into early trauma care significantly increases the probability of survival in patients with multiple trauma. And consequently, the whole body CT really should be recommended as the standard imaging modality in early evaluation of patients with polytrauma. And this is something that we can and should be applying to veterinary patients wherever possible. So if we move on from some sort of, you know, more general CT stuff to some more specific examples, and the next sections are sort of roughly divided up into a group of musculoskeletal cases, a collection of urogenital, and finally some respiratory cases. So CT is really perfectly designed for evaluation of the skeletal system. As the physical properties of bone are very different from that of other body system, of other body tissues, and the indications for the use of CT in musculoskeletal disease are also very varied. But some pretty obvious ones include things like trauma, so fractures, dislocations, metabolic bone disease, and really we're looking at sort of bone mineral density loss or deranged growth or pathological fractures or something like that. Nutritional disorders, so metastatic mineralization, something like that. Neoplasia, obviously, and I will and I'll mention that in a few slides time. So we're looking at sort of soft tissue or bone or something like that. Osteomyelitis and abscesses. Diseases of the head are a very important one for CT, where we have specific difficulties that arise due to the complexity of the skull and the range of overlying structures, and joint pathology, where good sort of reptile examples include things like gout or septic arthritis. So if we go back to our wonderful boa, I don't know whether you guys remember, with the bony abnormalities. So CT was used in this case, and this is a female, an 8-year-old female boa, who was presented as a referral due to abnormal posturing. So she had this sort of kink in her side, which I don't know whether it might be easier to see on this slide, just towards the back end there. That little kink, which looks quite normal there, didn't seem to iron out. So the owner brought them in and also noticed this sort of firm, knobbly mass on the right side. And as sort of mentioned previously, the CT was really, really valuable for a pre-surgical evaluation and surgical planning. And in this case, it was decided to perform an excisional biopsy. The rest of the scan looked absolutely normal. The clinical exam, other than these postural things and these lumps, was quite normal. And the surgery was performed to remove two of the ribs, and they were the ones with the most prominent bony thickening. And the results demonstrated, I think we were all expecting it to be a little bit more exciting, but they demonstrated really that this was a normal healing process. So it was assumed that through some unknown traumatic event in the past, the snake had started to, had fractured these ribs, and this was just a normal healing process. The snake is now on long-term pain relief. It's also getting acupuncture, and most recent reports are that it's doing very well. So moving on to look at the use of CT in a very common condition, and that's sort of pyramiding, which is related to metabolic bone disease. And on the left is a sort of 3D reconstruction of a young sulcata sortus suffering from severe pyramiding, as I'm sure you guys can see. And this gives you an idea of how the patient looked externally, and the next slide is looking at how it looks on the transverse view. The picture on the right is obviously a different sulcata, which is a far better formed one, but it's really just so that then you've got a bit of a comparison between the two. And the case on the left is really quite a typical presentation. I'm sure you guys have seen variations on a theme with this. But again, if we click onto the next one, we can just see what's happening below the shell here. So the bottom one is really just a sort of comparison imaging for so you can see what essentially a normal chelonia would look like. And you can now see in the upper image the depth of the pyramiding more accurately. But really, it's also important to appreciate that you've got sort of cortical bone thinning of the carapacial bones, and there's a severe restriction to the lung volume. You know, if you compare these two images, it really is quite dramatic. And you also get deviation of the septum that sits between the two lungs. If you compare it to this sort of beautifully aerated and enlarged lungs at the bottom, then you can see it might be really quite debilitating, not just as a sort of visual external thing, but you know, when you start to get below the shell. And the next case, it really shows a very, very odd an odd case where an adult female royal python was presented with generalized mineral nodules, and they were distributed really through the entire patient. The patient also has a celomic effusion, which I sort of highlighted there, which shows up on the CT grayscale in a very sort of similar way to an X-ray. Areas where these nodules were found include the cutis, the subcutis, the fascia, the pharynx, the esophagus, the gastrointestinal tract. There was some in pericardial fat. There was some in the liver, kidneys, ileumic cavity, and dotted around the cloaca. So it was distributed everywhere. And the 3D reconstruction off on the right hand side there shows just how widely distributed and how numerous these nodules were. The differential list that was provided was a sort of disseminated granulomatous disease, so that could be bacterial, fungal, or parasitic disease. Dystrophic mineralization was in there, neoplasia was in there. The ileumic effusion was considered to be related to whatever caused the mineralized nodule, so they were thinking it might be a septic or inflammatory ileumitis. You can see the nodule show up sort of really beautifully on these single slice tomograms. And again on the 3D reconstruction. And this is really a sort of excellent example of the use of CT in providing a comprehensive understanding on disease extent. And this patient was subsequently put to sleep. And amazingly, even though the entire snake was submitted for post-mortem, they still didn't get a definitive diagnosis back. And then we have this very sad-looking box turtle. And he was presented with severe shell trauma, as I'm sure you guys can see, of unknown origin. Nobody knew what happened to him. And I'll come back and I'll mention this case again towards the end in the sort of respiratory section. And it's not difficult to see the skeletal trauma, obviously, but the extent of damage and trauma to the underlying structures may be something that is far harder to appreciate on a clinical exam or even on X-ray. And really, it's just to show that this may be the difference between a general anaesthetic with some orthopedic repair or electing just to put him to sleep. If we move on to look at a bit of neoplastic disease, there's a huge range of presentations that can be attributable to neoplasia, so it's difficult to provide specific indications for CT use, but as a whole body screening tool in reptiles, it has exceptional value. And as mentioned previously, in our typically small and commonly sedentary patients, conscious full body CT can be achieved in a matter of minutes and provide a huge amount of information. And it's great for determining the extent of primary lesions, but it's also invaluable as identifying the presence of metastatic spread and ultimately, as I mentioned before, in planning surgery or radiotherapy, or even just electing to put them to sleep on with some good information. There are numerous research papers on the use of CT in the diagnosis of neoplastic disease and in the monitoring response to therapy, especially in humans. There's a reasonable amount in dogs. There's quite a lot less in cats, and predictably there's very, very little that's related to reptiles. And I've highlighted this one study by Hellinghaus in 2017 on humans with bone destruction caused by multiple myeloma, and the authors concluded that whole body CT was considered the current standard for detection of osteolytic lesions, and it identifies significantly more sites of bony destruction than whole body radiography in people. There's also another paper that found that CT detects 23% more lytic bone lesions than plain radiography in humans with plasma cell tumor, so it's really quite a sensitive imaging modality. If you have a quick look at a case example in a reptile, so this is a destructive scapular lesion in a tortoise. And the tortoise was presented for an acute onset left fore lameness, which was unresponsive to pain relief. A clinical exam was performed, blood work was performed, but both of them are pretty unremarkable. And the lesion wasn't obvious on initial plain radiography either. Unfortunately, the patient was euthanized because he became lethargic and inappetent, and based on the results of his CT scan, which demonstrated a pretty inaccessible lesion with few surgical options, the owner sadly elected to put him to sleep, and unfortunately we don't have any PM results from him either. But I think it really just highlights that CT really can be very, very accurate in these, and in the absence of any other information based on more traditional diagnostic routes. In terms of soft tissue masses, again, we really get some wonderful detail images, and this is a 400-gram male painted turtle that was presented with, you know, very typical non-specific signs, dullness, lethargy, poor appetite, stuff like that. And he went through the CT, and it was found that he had this sort of 3x3 approximately intracelomic mass, which I sort of highlighted in yellow there. And they, this was non-identifiable on a clinical exam, and it wasn't palpable on, via the prefemoral fossa, and on conventional radiography, it would probably be a miss because it would have been lost with all the other soft tissues into due to superimposition. But yeah, as you can see, it really does show up very beautifully on CT. And these are images of the same turtle, but this is with a transverse topogram. And so the two images really illustrate some of the different algorithms that you can use for image processing. And the image on the left is a soft tissue window, and you can kind of appreciate that while the bony shell obviously surrounding everything is very bright, it lacks the detail. With the image on the right, which has gone through a bone algorithm window. The mass, though, which is what we're really interested in, it appears very bright, and it's very obvious on the soft tissue window. But both images are highly diagnostic. I don't think you would miss that mass on either of those. And it importantly provides information on the size, the shape, and the relationship with internal structures that the mass has. Looking at this, and this is on a clinical exam anyway, is a more obvious case. So we've got a Solcata tortoise, and it's quite a young Solcata tortoise with this enormous 16 by 10 centimeter sort of intracelomic mass, and it's taking up around half of the coelom on the horizontal tomogram. And you've got this dramatic mass effect where it's displacing intestinal contents off to the right hand side. While on the sagittal view, which you can see on the right-hand side there, the mass is filling almost the entire coelomic space. This mass was palpable, obviously, with a digital assessment of the prefemoral fossa, but the dramatic size was certainly not appreciable on a clinical exam. So if we move on to consider some of the uses of CT in urogenital disease, and both radiography and ultrasound have been used pretty extensively and successfully for the diagnosis and monitoring of reproductive and urinary tract conditions in reptiles. And these imaging modalities are widely available, obviously, in first opinion practices. But as a single imaging option, CT provides the most comprehensive evaluation of the urogenital tract, and predictably it's of special value in tortoises and turtles. The inclusion of contrast will provide greater information on soft tissue structures. And as I mentioned previously, movement of contrast through things like the kidneys can provide some pretty useful information on function. So indications for use, it really includes almost all of the urogenital tract, and CT is superior to both radiography and ultrasound in that it will give you exact numbers of eggs and follicles. It also provides you some information regarding the size and the shape and the degree of mineralization and position of eggs within the coelomic cavity, and this may help in deciding whether a patient is a medical or a surgical case. Similarly, the internal architecture and size of follicles is appreciable, which provides some indication regarding follicle health and again whether surgery is indicated. Other indicators of more concerning pathology may be seen, so you may find the presence of intracelomic fluid and adhesions, and that might indicate there's coelomitis. The salpinx is a much harder structure to identify routinely, but certainly if it's inflamed and it's fluid filled, so if you have a salpingitis or something like that, then it may be appreciable on a CT scan as well. If we consider the urinary tract, uroliths or urinary calculi have been found in all those species that have a bladder, and so that's all of the chelonia and some of the lizard species. They've also been found in the distal ureters of those species that don't have a bladder, so snakes is the most common one. And this is really because that's where the urine is stored. The exact cause of lith formation is unknown, but it seems to be a sort of multifactorial poor husbandry issue with dietary excesses or deficiencies contributing. Chronic dehydration is an enormously important one that may that seems to affect a huge number of captive reptiles, and that can certainly contribute to the formation of lice. As in other species, presence of calculi in the bladder causes irritation, and with that straining and painful passage, and sometimes bloody urine and stuff like that. And sometimes, if the straining becomes very severe, you may get prolapses as well. In tortoises and turtles, it's also possible for eggs to find their way into the urinary bladder, and if an egg gets into the urinary bladder, it's really impossible for it to be passed normally. The presence of stones and smaller calculi within the urinary bladder shows up very nicely on CT, and as you can see on these images, you've got the main urolith are obviously very appreciable, but the images also show an expansive area of smaller calculi filling the urinary bladder, and that's sort of orange shaded patch on the right there. On these transverse images, it's not only possible to see very easily the main urinary calculi, and you can determine the position of the larger stones, but it's also possible to see how the very small sort of sand-like calculi have pooled and coalesced at the bottom of the bladder, and making passage without surgical intervention of some sort pretty unlikely. Renal pathology may be also identifiable on CT, and enlargements of the kidney due to neoplasia or fibrous thickening related to chronic renal disease may be found. Renal gout may be identifiable as well with uric acid crystals, and then they're initially deposited in the tubular epithelial cells, but over time they form these sort of linear crystalline streaks through the organ. And again, gout is considered to be a sort of multifactorial disease, and again, chronic dehydration, inappropriate husbandry, high protein diets, they seem to be major contributors as well. The final section I'm going to go on to is on respiratory disease. And the classifications of respiratory disease in reptiles really mirrors that of mammals with infectious and non-infectious, primary, secondary, upper respiratory tract, lower respiratory tract, all factoring. Ideally, images should be combined with sampling procedures such as washes or biopsies, and really that's then you can get a definitive diagnosis. The list of causes of respiratory disease in reptiles also is very similar to other animals, so you get various different viral, bacterial, fungal, and parasitic organisms. But unlike the situation in mammals, respiratory infection in reptiles are commonly multifactorial and very, very commonly related to poor husbandry. Foreign bodies can be seen, and lizards and chelonia seem to be a bit overrepresented in this category. So, ingestion of obstructing substrate, for example, things like small stones or bits of bark or something like that. Traumatic injury, as we mentioned in the past, so for example, penetrating injuries, bites, being trodden on or driven over or something like that. Neoplasia and respiratory neoplasia is reported uncommonly in the in reptile literature. And it's unclear whether this is because the reptiles are resistant to it, or whether because respiratory compromise can be difficult to identify in reptiles, or whether it's not being investigated fully, or possibly, and very sadly, because many reptile patients don't live long enough to develop things like neoplasia. And CT is considered really the most sensitive and specific of all the imaging modalities when it comes to diagnosing respiratory disease in reptiles. So over the next few slides, I'll just sort of run through some interesting normal anatomy of snakes and chelonian lungs, and finish off with a couple of examples of pathological conditions, because CT has been used quite extensively to look at the anatomy of reptiles. And the transverse CT scans provide excellent visualization of the reptile lung fields. The snake in this series is a boa, and as in most other snake species, the left lung is always reduced or even absent in boa snakes. And we can visualize this as we move caudally through the CT slices. So these are the cranial lung fields that you can see here, and it's easy to appreciate the sort of central gas opacity in both lungs, and that's really characteristic of the sort of sac-like lungs of reptiles. And already it's possible to see the thinner nature of the gas exchange region in the left lung when you compare that to the right lung. And then as we move caudally, you can see that the respiratory exchange surface pretty much disappeared from the left lung, and it becomes more akin to a sort of avian air sac. On the right side, it's starting to thin, much as the left did further cranially. the lung length of the left lung never exceeds about 85% of the length of the sort of total length of the right lung, but the degree of reduction fluctuates and depends largely on individuals and species. Further caudally, the left lung is almost absent, really, while the right is wide. But again, as has happened with the left lung further cranially, the gas exchange region has markedly thinned, and we're sort of entering a bit of a transitional zone. If we kept going caudally, the right lung would continue alone, and then it would also turn into this sort of a sort of non-respiratory air sac area. If we move on to look at some normal chelonian anatomy, and CT is really regarded as the imaging modality of choice when it comes to assessing the respiratory tract of tortoises and turtles. Rapid scanning and the slow respiratory rate and the ability to scan fully conscious patients means that CT provides really highly detailed images without risk in some of our very badly debilitated patients. Anatomically, the chelonian lung sits very high in the cloacic cavity, just under the carapace, and again is a sort of thin sac-like structure when you compare it to sort of mammalian or avian lungs. Unlike snakes, however, the chelonians have a sort of multi-chambered lung, which extends caudally almost to the level of the kidneys. This horizontal CT slice shows the lungs reaching the carapacial borders, so sort of filling the whole of the top of the cloacic cavity, and also shows the septum that separates the right and left lungs, and even I think you can possibly see some of the very, very fine reticular network and some of the larger blood vessels running through it as well. The sagittal slice of the same patient shows the lungs reaching it illustrates the position of the lungs, the lung fields occupying the cloacic cavity, and really they sit right up against the carapace dorsally and extend almost half the length and nearly the half the depth rather and nearly the full length of the cloacic cavity. And again, some of the larger blood vessels and the very fine reticular network are visible. Reptiles have a much larger lung volume than similarly sized mammals, but the gas exchange surface is only around 20% of the mammalian counterparts. So looking at some of the pathological cases that we have, and this is going back to that wee box turtle with the carapacial trauma, and these are slightly different images from the previous section. And it's now possible to see the sort of extent of the hemorrhage into the lung fields caused by trauma. And amazingly, the patient demonstrated no evidence of respiratory distress. Chelonians seem to be more resilient to the effects of lung trauma than mammals do. The movement of the air into and out of the lungs is largely dependent on physical movement of the head and the limbs rather than intercostals and diaphragms as we see in mammals. And the lungs are, as I mentioned before, are sort of sac-like and suspended from the ventral carapace by the pulmonary ligament, rather than using sort of surfactant and surface tensions to sort of hold the lungs open as you would see in mammals. And this sort of next and last case demonstrates this is a 10-year-old timber rattlesnake, and again these images are thanks to the University of Georgia, so we don't see a lot of these guys in Scotland certainly, but these are transverse tomograms of a 10-year-old timber rattlesnake. And it had quite a long history of again very non-specific clinical signs such as lethargy and hyperexia and weight loss, the guys over at UGA performed a full body CT, and it highlighted this heterogeneous soft tissue mass located in the cranial lung field. Unfortunately, the patient was subsequently euthanized, and really that was because there was a sort of declining clinical picture, and given the results of the CT scan, the prognosis was likely to be poor, and sadly no post-mortem was performed to identify exactly what the mass was. However, I think this case does sort of demonstrate how valuable CT can be as a screening test, as I suspect finding this mass using other diagnostic methods would have been extremely difficult. And so by way of a sort of summary, conclusion to all of this, it's it's not just technology which is driving the increased use and availability of CT. Vets and exotic pet owners are expecting access to the same range of diagnostic procedures as other companion animals. CT has become a lot cheaper, and that's really improved an awful lot over the last 10 years or so. And this is in line with sort of technological advancements and reduced equipment costs. The majority of CT scans can and are being performed in conscious reptile patients, which significantly increases patient safety and the speed of the procedure. And due to the typically small size of reptile patients, whole body CTs are commonly achievable and provide very detailed 3D information, not only on the specific areas of concern, but also on concurrent and sometimes on apparent diseases, as I hope you've seen from the previous slides. And 3D imaging is an incredibly powerful tool that provides detailed information on disease extent and its relationship with adjacent structures. And this allows optimal surgical planning and therapeutic decision making. And finally, the ability to see beneath the chelonian shell without superimposition makes CT especially valuable in tortoises and turtles. And thank you very much for listening.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Martin for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.